This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, Sharat, you want to share your thoughts on the Yale Milgram experiment.
Yeah, that's because I watched a movie that was released some years ago, and actually just last year. It's called The Experimenter, and basically it's sort of a movie documentary styled movie around this exact event, and the person who was the social psychologist, if you like, who pushed this experiment through and then went on to quite a bit of fame and infamy, Stanley Milgram. Mm-hmm. And as he says several times in the movie, Milgram is the Yiddish word for pomegranate.
Wow.
So he's Jewish, Russian, whatever extraction, some Eastern European extraction. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's at Yale University. Mm-hmm. And what I think social psychology was doing at that point was trying to capture, in some sense, people's behavioral patterns, and so the setup is very simple. I think everybody knows it. In fact,
Why don't we rehash that first, just so that everybody's on the same page. So what is this experiment and why is it significant?
Okay. So what happens is the person who's participating in the experiment is invited in, and he comes into a room. He's met with a man in a coat, and not a white coat, but a gray coat, and there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. And he's, in fact, there are two men, and they're asked to choose who's going to be the teacher and who's going to be the subject who's going to be learning. Mm-hmm. And the point, as it's explained to those two men, is that they're testing for how people learn. Mm-hmm. And to what extent rewards and punishments help or incentivize or disincentivize teaching. So one person goes off. They both go off to a little room. They draw lots, as it were. And one person is strapped in, and they're told that they're going to be given these tiny little shocks, and if they get the questions wrong. Mm-hmm. Right. So the other person then goes to another room, and he doesn't actually see the person, the subject, mm-hmm. but he can hear him, mm-hmm. or he can hear a little bit of him, mm-hmm. and he can communicate, but the other person doesn't have a microphone as well to communicate back. Mm-hmm. So that's a setup. Mm-hmm. And as the experiment proceeds, before that, the teacher, as it were, now the teacher who's giving the questions is also given a sample of the electric shock mm-hmm. they're going to be administering. Mm-hmm. So, and then they ask, how many volts do you think it is? Right. So then they calibrate it. So he says, I know how much pain that is. Mm-hmm. And that's my starting point. Okay. So then it's calibrated for him. And what happens is everybody who sits in the position of teacher goes through the questions. You'll find that eventually the subject is not learning. It's constantly getting their questions wrong. So mm-hmm. the voltage increases. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The question is, at what point, and of course along the way, they hear voices, they will hear the
people in pain, essentially.
Somebody's in pain, right? So the other person they met, who they assume is, just like them, signed on to this experiment, is shouting, ouch, or then saying, look, I really want to stop this. I don't want to carry on. But, and the person who's the teacher turns to the man in the coat and says, or doesn't say, should I carry on? What's mm-hmm, happening? Mm-hmm. But they found that in 65% of the people, who were subjects of this experiment, and now the question is, who's the subject? Mm-hmm. They just carried on, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that they thought that they were administering high levels of pain. So mm-hmm. it got to a point where it says high voltage, quite intense pain. And of course, this whole thing was a ruse. Mm-hmm. The person in the room was also part of the experiment.
Right, right.
And the real subject is the teacher.
Right.
The person administering the pain. Mm-hmm. So what Stanley Milgram was interested in doing, and he initially thought that he could do this experiment in America and then do something in Berlin, because the experiment really begins at the same time as the Eichmann trial, because mm-hmm. this was the Nazi, who was kidnapped and brought to Jerusalem to stand trial for war crimes. And his whole thing was, I was just taking orders. Mm-hmm. So Stanley Milgram thought he would find very different types of responses to authority in America and then in Germany. What he found was high levels of conformity to authority in America. Mm-hmm. Now, that is the start of the controversy. Mm-hmm. There are other controversies that come along the way that include the ethics mm-hmm. of the experiment itself. But that was the premise of the experiment and really got me thinking about the kind of work that was being done then and the concerns about authority, which I guess in some ways share about this country.
Right, of course. Yeah, especially when authority seems to be, at least in the case of these men in grey coats, to be legitimizing the process, right?
Absolutely. So there's a very conscious effort. And you know, what you learn from the documentary is they change the permutations, the environment, to perhaps mm-hmm. blunt any intimidation that the teacher, who mm-hmm. is the true subject, would feel as a consequence. What they're constantly asserting is that every subject goes in there. They're told, here's cash for mm-hmm. the experiment, and you will get this cash regardless of how the experiment proceeds. So that's the first thing that's put laid down. So they're not going to lose money. Right? Perhaps they'll lose a bit of time, but they're not going to lose money. And then
so money just clears out the incentive question, right?
That's
so
right.
To make sure that they're not doing this just for the money they get. Yeah.
And what's interesting is, of course, the anomalies. So 65% of people who did this, you know, who said, well, they just carried on and mm-hmm. they might have some disquiet, they might have, you know, expressed it in their bodily movements, you know, right. a bit anguish, right. you know, and all that. But at the end of the day, they just went right to the top of the line in terms of the voltage. And one of the examples it gives, the person who didn't, was a Dutchman who just basically says, no, I'm not doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, many of the subjects would turn around to the man in the lab coat and say, who's taking responsibility for it?
Right.
But in every instance,
which is an interesting question too, right? Who has to answer for that process? Yeah. And that's a question of authority. Who's in charge?
Yeah.
Right.
So as long as I don't have to answer and the person higher up has to answer, I'll obey orders, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe if that had changed, people would, you know, recognizing the issue of consequence, right? Mm-hmm. So every action I take or every decision I make has a consequence for which I bear mm-hmm. the sole moral or primary moral responsibility.
You mentioned something about the significance of the color of the coats.
Yeah. So what they wanted to do was to not mimic a medical professional. Mm-hmm. Is that what it was? White, it would look like too much like a doctor, like a hospital. Right. So they want to get something a little more, it's authoritative, but it's not medical. Right. They didn't want to confuse. So, you know, you see how the minds of socialists, like what they're trying to do is, and that's really very interesting. You might say, this is a false experiment, or you say it's ethically dubious because it was based on lies or an illusion mm-hmm. and it caused trauma to the subjects. But at the end of the day, you know, it was trying to elicit a real response. But of course, real life and history provides us those real responses. Correct. All one has to do is to look at history.
Yeah, to look at any working of bureaucracy, right? Where, I mean, of course, it's not physically pain inflicting or damaging, but the idea that you do not have to answer for the consequences of your choices is what makes essentially an institutional system. Right.
It's been an experiment that's been repeated several times, but I guess one of the other issues is, okay, what do you do with this 35? And in the documentary, they don't really explain. Mm-hmm. There is a book, and I haven't read the book, but it's called Obedience to Authority, an Experimental View. It came out in 1974. The experiments took place in 61, so mm-hmm. quite some years after the experiments.
Now, just for the context, the actual subject of these experiments, the teacher, they are administering these so-called lessons individually. So it's not a room where there's many of them. So it's like one by one.
No. Yeah, it is, in fact, one by one. They're separate. They don't know. Because the person who plays the subject, so the ruse is this, right? Mm-hmm. You're given two sticks, one, you know, two pieces of paper. You can choose from either hand whether you become student or teacher. Mm-hmm. I'm sure in both hands, the words teacher are written on the piece of paper, right? And they're given to the person who is going to be the subject. Mm-hmm. Now, the student is always the same guy. And mm-hmm. so in the movie, you see this guy, and he's a good actor. I mean, he just manages to...
Yeah, he has to feign pain many times a day.
He doesn't because they record everything. And they just play the recording, or the whatever. So he's just sitting there, and he's listening to himself. He's already recorded as far as I understand. But Stanley Milgram, in this documentary, they mentioned that his teacher, the person who, you know, he studied under, was very famous for another study. And that had to do with peer pressure. treasure. Mm. And so that was a room study. So basically, you have six people. Only one of them is a true subject. He thinks he's with six other, you know, five other people who are also subjects of the experiment. And it's an optical illusion mm-hmm. about the length of a line. And that length of a line, so what happens is the true subject is the fifth in order of answering the question, mm-hmm. which line corresponds to which line. So you have these lines, and because right. of their relational thing, there's a bit of an optical illusion.
Correct.
But what happens is after time, the subject, even when the answer is patently wrong,
will follow the majority answer. Yeah.
Yeah. So this tendency for peer pressure, you know, it was so strong. The question is, it's about lines. And I think Stanley Milgram, you know, having worked under this professor, thought to himself, well, that's not good enough. I need something right. that has real world consequences. Yeah. About a human
more
being.
Visceral, I would say, yeah. Because you're responsible for the well-being of another person directly.
Right.
Yeah.
Then, of course, you know, one has to only look at history, right? Mm-hmm. And history provides you a much messier picture, right? And this is what, because some social scientists don't like. What they're trying to do is to declutter the experiment or the situation so you can somehow hone in mm-hmm. on the specifics, you know, and say, well, actually, I've located the source of the problem. And I think something that we might want to talk about after this, which is what kind of cultural resources or even institutional and social resources are there for people to not conform,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Though one of the things that Stanley Milgram's teacher tells him in this one of the scenes in the documentary is that, Stanley, you're always looking at the negative side of obedience.
Mm-hmm.
Obedience is necessary for society.
Right,
so, you know,
right.
so that
There's
is the
that
other
line.
Side. Yeah,
Correct.
That's the other side of it.
That's fascinating. And this is the thing. I mean, we always think about conformity and obedience in, you know, in general terms. But now we have a specific experiment to point to and from there kind of dissect the possible implications. So, yeah, we've really covered the general picture of the Milgram experiment. And in the second part of the show, we'll get into specifics. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutan as usual. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. This is Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutan as usual. And we're talking about the Yale famous experiment at Yale University conducted by Stanley Milgram that's, you know, now referred to popularly as the Milgram experiment. And essentially, it proves the cover of authority in unethical acts. Essentially, the extent to which people are willing to commit wrongdoing and harm to others because they were under orders or because they perceive themselves to be unanswerable to them because someone else will. You mentioned the Eichmann trials earlier, Sharad, and I see a lot of parallels here because Eichmann too became the subject of a famous theory about evil, often referred to as the banality of evil, by Hannah Arendt, and the thesis is quite simple but quite captivating because it shows that evil is not supernatural, evil is not extraordinary, but it's something that is embedded in our more mundane and kind of commonplace attitudes, right, about what we have to do and what work means. And one of the things that Hannah Arendt concluded was that, look, Eichmann, he's a Nazi, he was responsible for millions of deaths, but ultimately he's just a careerist bureaucrat following orders, working with the system, and that shows that evil is. But not similarly, you see in this experiment, the subjects, they're not super villains, right? In the way we think of evil these days, but are just average people who just sign up for the experiment and to get paid and to just learn something along the way. But what we find is that just how easily it is that they con this role of administering pain.
Yeah, you know, he also has this idea that comes in the last part of the documentary called the agentic state.
Mm-hmm.
And he refers to the way in which people become a certain creature, right? They fall into or adopt a kind of script,
mm-hmm.
and their expressions that they use to deal with everyday life is, this is not my job, you'd have to refer to somebody
else,
you know, and all that is really part of the language, the vocabulary of somebody whose mind is captive of these structures of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was very taken by that because that's exactly what we hear all the time. You hear this in people's language. Of course, you hear it most intensely with bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, that's also part of the bureaucrat's SOP. They're supposed to keep those lines very clear. You know, if every bureaucrat had absolute discretion and was just milling about and, you know, walking from department to department, you'd probably have chaos.
Correct.
Right? So the idea that those bureaucratic lines preserve some order, you know, is on one side rational, but on the flip side, it has some really dark consequences.
Correct. And one of the dark consequences is that you accept and you reinforce in your participation in this flow of things conformity, right? The reason why, if you look at the bigger picture, the reason why we just sign up for these scripts, why we perform these roles without questioning, or how we ease into very, very difficult decisions without really feeling the ethical implications, is that we know this is what it means to be a part of the setup, right? And everybody plays the role in ensuring that the setup remains what it is. So authority and conformity in many ways goes hand in hand.
You know, one of the things that, of course, comes along with this is, I mean, the idea or the question that might ask, well, could a whole nation be subject to this kind of mass mesmerization by the, you know, the bureaucratic order, if you like to put it that way? And at the end of the documentary, they make mention of recent reiterations of this experiment, they repeat this experiment. One that included, I mean, something that's a part of our new reality, which is, you know, the crowd and the cheering crowd.
Yeah.
And what's very interesting, because I watched a recent series of fictional works called Dark Mirror. And Dark Mirror, and one of them called Waldo, has this kind of like electronic character. And when the subject, the behind the character, revolts and runs out of the van, as it were, I mean, don't want to tell you too much about that scene, but Waldo is taken over by somebody else who then encourages the crowd around that character to kind of beat him up, say, well, I'll give you 50 ringgit. Sorry, 50, actually it was 50 pounds.
Yes.
I'll give you 50 quid if you beat this guy up, right? But in the experiment, what they found is instead of the kind of 65%, they were getting 85% compliance when you had a crowd cheering on the subject, the teacher.
And what makes that interesting for me, most cases of conformity that I pay attention to is the emotive dimension of it, right? So you mentioned the cheering crowd, and there's something very inward, right? Like an inward fulfillment in being urged on by a mass of people. You feel affirmation, you feel that you belong in a certain frame. It makes it harder for you to question the choice because you're not really confronting your inner monologue, but this rather, you know, this bigger picture that you were supposed to so-called fit into. So that I find interesting, that in relationships of domination, there's always some sort of emotional investment in it. So I don't obey just because I kind of have to, but it gives me a certain feeling. It allows me a certain experience of relating to someone or a bigger society or community.
I think, you know, the other thing you realize, especially I think it's true of celebrities perhaps, when you seek affirmation from the crowd and you get it, and you get it at a certain kind of critical mass, what you're also painfully aware of this simultaneously is that same crowd is deeply fickle and can turn on you.
Exactly.
And, you know, so I am certain there is this fear that the crowd will turn on you. So to disappoint the crowd, you know, not even to confuse the crowd or you know, kind of like, you know, say, well, I'm going to take some time out. Let's just talk about it, right? You can't disappoint the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
The crowd, there's a certain urgency. They want to be, you know, they want to, their bloodlust, if you like, if it comes to that, it needs to be satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
And so there must be this fear. So, okay, coming back to the whole question of Eichmann and Nazi Germany, the documentary really doesn't go there, but there's a wonderful scene when Stanley Milgram goes into the corridor and he's talking to the camera and telling you about why he was doing this. You see in the background this elephant, and the elephant is walking with him. And of course, it's just a visual gag.
Sure.
The elephant in the room.
Right.
Or in this case, the elephant in the corridor. But, and that was it, right? It was this whole, I mean, where was America in 1961? If you think of the context, right, there were deep divisions.
Correct.
There was
Social unrest, a lot of social unrest.
Yeah. You know, there was a fight for equality for African Americans, the racial injustice.
A new generation, the baby boom generation. Too.
Right, so extraordinary. And of course, the question of disorder. And you have people arguing that, in some sense, social cohesion in America was breaking down and needed to be restored, perhaps by a great line. I mean, I'm thinking of, because of philosophers who put some thought into
The idea of a noble lie, right? That's Plato, right? The idea that you kind of, you know, put everybody intact, right? Put society intact, because fragmentation is the worst thing possible. So you have to tell some lies so that people kind of buy into things. I mean, myth is another term that's not as loaded as lie, right? But it's nonetheless captivating, right? For societies, for even families.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the work of Leo Strauss. You know, I was struggling to remember his name just now. Mm-hmm. But Leo Strauss, of course, you know, is said to be the kind of father of the neocon movement, right? And again, this idea, I mean, in not to kind of use that as a way of saying his work is unimportant.
No, not at all, not at all. Right? He's very important, yeah.
So, and then maybe one of these days we should have a deeper look at Leo Strauss and his work. But the idea that this was America, this was what, in some ways, Stanley Milgram, who died rather tragically, he was like 51 when he died, it was really trying to come to terms with, you know, coming out of the war, knowing that his parents could have ended up in a gas chamber somewhere, you know, run by the Nazis, trying to understand the human condition, I think. So the experiment itself seemed very simple. Mm-hmm. And he went on to do a lot of other very simple experiments. So for instance, there was this quite a wonderful little experiment which has to do with leaving an envelope with stamps and an address and, in fact, a letter inside unattended, you know, either on a car or a strike, and seeing the rate of return. Mm-hmm. But the options were, so they had four different addresses. One was addressed to kind of some benign-sounding society. One to just an odd, kind of a name, you know, like a John Smith or something not so ordinary, but, you know, but again, with no specific identity. And then one to the Nazi Party and of America, and one to the Communist Party, the Friends of the Communist Party of America. And the rate of return, meaning some stranger picked it up, looked at the contents, but definitely looked at the address and decided to put it in a postbox. Mm-hmm. Much higher when it came to either the very benign sounding organization or the ordinary person, but very low, significantly lower when it came to the Nazi Party or the, you know, Friends of the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. Again, people's biases. Correct. So he was, you know, so Stanley Milgram is trying to find ways of confirming what in many ways we all know or have an intuitive feel about each other, that we follow our biases, for instance.
Yeah, correct. And sometimes we do it more when we have enough cover to do it. So I'm thinking about riots and lootings and when the moral fiber just breaks down, right? And we don't feel any obligation and we're swept by this fervor of the moment just to, you know, follow our most base desires.
Like mob rule.
Right, mob rule, yeah. So it just shows, I think maybe one of the arguments that you cannot take for granted too, the value of conformity. Not that, you know, I'm all for it, but there's a reason why systems, leaders, and so much philosophy has gone into exploring conformity and why it's so seductive, right?
Right. So, okay. So we have mob rule. We see how the rather dramatic effects of mob rule on its own. But Milgram's experiment wasn't about the mob.
No.
Right? Yeah. It really was about this rather sanitized environments where ordinary good people who otherwise would not do it. And, you know, there are many characters in this documentary that come up to Stanley Milgram and talk to him about it. Say they went back, they spoke to their spouses. They were anguished by what had happened. They just didn't believe they could do it.
But, you know, Shira, I wonder why sometimes that, and this is where I have some methodological differences with the social sciences or even the behavioral sciences, that yeah, good people do bad things. It's not, I don't think it's that much even of a breakthrough then. But of course, he comes from a specific, you know, vantage point, you know, in terms of his scientific practice. But I think that's enough intuitively. You know, if you kind of pay attention to the kind of people you encounter in life and your own inconsistencies, that we are made of this spectrum of, you know, possible choices and attitudes, you know.
Okay, so there is a scene where Milgram is facing a committee, right? They're trying to decide on the ethics of his experiment. And his defense is, he says, well, in fact, this committee had once said that their guess was that people would stop, and they would stop fairly early on, right? So in fact, it went against the grain. It went against the intuition of people at that point in time. Mm-hmm. At least that was conveyed in these, you know, the scholarly circles, that the results would show otherwise. So the fact that the results showed otherwise for Milgram was the breakthrough, because it wasn't received wisdom that people would carry on, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, under those conditions. And he tried to change those conditions, you know.
And I think you're right. In that sense, it's not so much about the fact that we're all grey, that we're not either good or bad, but just how far we are willing to inflict pain on some stranger under the cover of order, right?
Yeah, and, you know, and this is, you know, my own fear about the cover order, the costumes it wears, whether it's in the form of the authority of the state or religious authority. I mean, all of them, you know, blunt our basic human instincts to kind of recognize, you know, to empathize with the pain that is being suffered by somebody else. I think so you see so much cruelty in the world. I mean, justified not happening in the spur of the moment, but really justify people thinking they're upholding order, the mm-hmm. divine rule, or, you know, mm-hmm. God's agenda, whatever it is, you know. But they were willing to commit the worst atrocities in the name of those orders. And that, I think, is really in some ways what Milgram was trying. I mean, I don't know if his work is going to stand the test of time, but, you know, it certainly...
It's fascinating. I mean, it raises a lot of interesting questions. Fascinating. So we have to wrap up. So the recommendation, I assume, is this film, this documentary.
Well, actually, if we were true to the spirit of Night School, we'd say the recommendation is the book, which I will remind you, the title of which is Obedience to Authority in Experimental View. And it's written by the psychologist Stanley Milgram. Milgram, again, a Yiddish word for pomegranate.
I wonder if there's any metaphorical significance.
No,
there.
But apparently there's, I don't know, Jewish tradition, pomegranates are one of the seven holy fruits. I don't know what the other six are, but anyway, yeah, so pomegranate is there. But if you want to catch the movie, which might just whet your appetite for the thing, it's called The Experimenter. And it was it aired in 2015, so it's about an hour and 38 minutes long, and it's an American movie, and, you know, really in a very clever way, not very heavy-handed, and interesting enough in terms of the characters and their ability to pull off a great performance. Yeah, I would.
Cool. When
I
was, when was that released?
So 2015.
Oh, 2015. Oh,
2015, right. Yeah, right.
Okay, cool. You know, we also mentioned Eichmann in Jerusalem by Hannah Arendt, which also made waves around the same time as The Experiment. So you have these two to compare fascinating theories with. So thanks a lot, Sharad, for that exposition, and we hope you've enjoyed it. We are on bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Should you want to email us, look us up on Facebook too. That's BFM Night School. Just type that on search space. Sharad is on Twitter.
Yeah, at Sharad Kutin, and you want to engage with me with, you know, in my angst-ridden, you know, moments around the many political issues of the day, you can do that with me at Sharad Kutin.
Wonderful. So thank you again for listening. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.